Disc 3.
Your skin was oily, Benton says, according to Brenda. She detected a fragrance, a nice fragrance like a perfumed body lotion.
He didn't put it on me.
He?
It must have been a he. Don't you think it was a he?
She says in a hopeful tone that rings off key, the way voices sound when people are trying to fool themselves or others.
It couldn't have been a she, a woman. Women don't do things like that.
Women do all sorts of things. Right now, we don't know if it was a man or a woman. Several head hairs were found on the mattress in the bedroom, black curly ones, maybe 5-6 inches long.
Well, we'll know soon enough, right? They can get DNA from the hair and find out it's not a woman, she says.
I'm afraid they can't. The kind of DNA testing they're doing can't determine gender. Possibly race, but not gender. And even race will take at least a month. Then you think you might have put on the body lotion yourself?
No, but he didn't. I wouldn't have let him do it. I would have fought him if I'd had a chance. He probably wanted to do it.
And you didn't put the lotion on yourself?
I said he didn't, and I didn't, and that's enough. It's none of your business.
Benton understands. The lotion has nothing to do with the attack, assuming Henry is telling the truth. Lucy enters his thoughts, and he feels sorry for her and is angry with her at the same time.
Tell me everything, Henry says. Tell me what you think happened to me. You tell me what happened, and I'll agree or disagree.
She smiles. Lucy came home, Benton says, and this is old information now. He resists revealing too much too soon. It was a few minutes past noon, and when she unlocked the front door, she noticed immediately that the alarm wasn't armed. She called out to you. You didn't answer. And she heard the back door that leads out to the pool bang against the doorstop, and she ran in that direction. When she got into the kitchen, she discovered the door leading out to the pool in the seawall was wide open.
Henry stares wide-eyed past Benton, out the window again. I wish she'd killed him.
She never saw whoever it was. It's possible the person heard her pull up in the driveway in her black Ferrari and ran.
He was in my room with me, and then had to go down all those stairs.
Henry interrupts, staring off with wide eyes, and at this moment, it feels to Benton that she is telling the truth. Lucy didn't park in the garage this time because she was only stopping by to check on you, Benton says. So she was in the front door quickly, came in the front door as he was running out the back door. She didn't chase him. She never saw him. At that moment, Lucy's focus was on you, not whoever had gotten into the house.
I disagree, Henry says almost happily.
Tell me.
She didn't drive up in her black Ferrari. It was in the garage. She had the California blue Ferrari. That's the one she parked out front.
More new information. And Benton remains calm, very easygoing. You were sick in bed, Henry. Are you sure you know what she drove that day?
I always know. She wasn't driving the black Ferrari because it got damaged.
Tell me about the damage.
It got damaged in a parking lot, Henry says, studying her bruised toe again. You know, the gym up there on Atlantic, way up there in Coral Springs, where we go to the gym sometimes?
Can you tell me when this happened? Benton asks, calmly, not showing the excitement he feels. The information is new and important, and he senses where it leads. The black Ferrari got damaged while you were in the gym? Benton prods her to tell the truth.
I didn't say I was in the gym, she snaps, and her hostility confirms his suspicions.
She took Lucy's black Ferrari to the gym, obviously without Lucy's permission. No one is allowed to drive the black Ferrari, not even Rudy. Tell me about the damage, Benton says.
Someone scratched it, like with a car key, something like that. Scratched a picture on it.
She stares down at her feet, picking at her yellowish big toe. What was the picture?
She wouldn't drive it after that. You don't take out a scratched Ferrari.
Lucy must have been angry, Benton says.
It can be fixed. Anything can be fixed. If she'd killed him, I wouldn't have to be here. Now I'll have to worry the rest of my life that he's going to find me again.
I'm doing my best to make sure you'll never have to worry about that, Henry. But I need your help.
I may never remember.
She looks at him.
I can't help it.
Lucy ran up 3 flights of stairs to the master bedroom. That's where you were, Benton says, watching her carefully, making sure she can handle what he is saying, even though she has heard this part before. All along, he has feared that she might not be acting, that none of what she says and does is an act. What if it isn't? She could break with reality, become psychotic, completely decompensate and shatter. She listens, but her affect isn't normal.
When Lucy found you, you were unconscious, but your breathing and heart rate were normal.
I didn't have anything on.
She doesn't mind that detail. She likes reminding him of her naked body.
Do you sleep in the nude?
I like to.
Do you remember if you'd taken off your pajamas before you got back into bed that morning?
Probably I did.
So he didn't do it. The attacker didn't. Assuming it's a he.
He didn't need to. I'm sure he would have, though.
Lucy says that when she saw you last at about 8 a.m., you were wearing red satin pajamas and a tan terry cloth robe.
I agree, because I wanted to go outside. I sat in a lounge chair by the pool in the sun.
More new information, and he asks,
what time was this?
Right after Lucy left, I think. She drove off in the blue Ferrari. Well, not right after.
She corrects herself in a flat tone and stares out at the snow-covered, sun-dazzled morning.
I was mad at her.
Benton slowly gets up and places several logs on the fire. Sparks fly up the chimney, and flames greedily lick the bone-dry pine.
She hurt your feelings, he says, drawing the mesh curtain shut.
Lucy isn't nice when people get sick,
Henry replies, more focused, more poised.
She didn't want to take care of me.
What about the body lotion, he asks.
And he has figured out the body lotion. He's pretty sure he has, but it is smart to make absolutely sure.
So what? Big deal. That's a favor now, isn't it? You know how many people would love to do that? I let her as a favor. She'll only do so much, only what suits her. Then she gets tired of taking care of me. My head hurt, and we were arguing.
How long did you sit out by the pool?
Benton says, trying not to get distracted by Lucy, trying not to wonder what the hell she was thinking when she met Henry Walden. And at the same time, he is all too aware of how impressive and bewitching sociopaths can be, even to people who should know better.
Not long. I didn't feel good.
15 minutes? Half an hour?
I guess half an hour.
Did you see any other people? Any boats?
I didn't notice, so maybe there weren't any. What did Lucy do when she was in the room with me?
She called 911, continued checking your vital signs while she waited for the rescue squad, Benton says.
He decides to add another detail, a risky one.
She took photographs.
Did she have a gun out?
Yes.
I wish she'd killed him.
You keep saying he.
And she took pictures of me,
Henry says.
You were unconscious but stable. She took pictures of you before you were moved.
Because I looked like I had been attacked?
Because your body was in an unusual position, Henry. Like this.
He straightens out his arms and holds them over his head.
You were face down with your arms stretched out in front of you, palms down. Your nose was bleeding and you had bruises, as you know. And your right big toe was broken, although that wasn't discovered until later. You don't seem to remember how it got broken.
I might have stubbed it going down the stairs, she says.
You remember that? He asks.
And she has remembered nothing or admitted nothing about her toe before now.
When might this have happened?
When I went out by the pool. Her stone stairs. I think I missed a step or something, because of all the medicine and my fever and everything. I remember crying, I remember that. Because it hurt, really hurt. And I thought about calling her, but why bother? She doesn't like it when I'm sick or hurt.
You broke your toe going down to the pool and thought of calling Lucy, but didn't.
He wants to make this clear.
I agree, she says mockingly. Where were my pajamas and robe?
Neatly folded on a chair near the bed. Did you fold them and put them there?
Probably. Was I under the covers?
He knows where she is going with this, but it is important that he tell her the truth.
No. He replies. The covers were pulled down to the bottom of the bed, were hanging off the mattress.
I didn't have anything on, and she took pictures, Henry says, and her face is expressionless as she looks at him with hard, flat eyes.
Yes,
Benton says. That figures. She would do something like that. Always the cop.
You're a cop, Henry. What would you have done?
She would do something like that, she says.
Chapter 8.
Where are you? Marino asks when he sees Lucy's number in the display of his vibrating cell phone. What's your location?
He always asks her where she is, even if the answer isn't relevant.
Marino has spent his adult life in policing, and one detail a good cop never overlooks is location.
It doesn't do a damn bit of good to get on your radio and scream Mayday if you don't know where you are.
Marino considers himself Lucy's mentor, and doesn't let her forget it, even if she forgot it long years back.
Atlantic,
Lucy's voice returns in his right ear.
I'm in the car.
No joke, Sherlock. You sound like you're in a damn garbage disposal.
Marino never misses an opportunity to give her a hard time about her cars.
Jealousy is so unattractive, she says.
He walks several steps away from the OCME coffee area, looking around, seeing no one, and satisfied that his conversation isn't overheard.
Look, it ain't going so good up here,
he says, peeking through the small glass window in the shut library door, seeing if anyone is inside. No one is.
The joint's gone to hell.
He keeps talking into his tiny cell phone, moving it back and forth between his ear and mouth, depending on whether he's listening or speaking.
I'm just giving you a heads up.
After a pause, Lucy replies,
You're not just giving me a heads up. What do you want me to do?
Damn, that car is loud.
He paces, his eyes constantly moving beneath the brim of the LAPD baseball cap Lucy gave him as a joke.
Okay, so now you're starting to worry me, she says above the roar of her Ferrari. I should have known when you said this was no big deal, it was going to turn out to be a big deal. Damn it! I warned you. I warned both of you not to go back there.
There's more to it than this dead girl, he replies quietly. That's what I'm getting at. It ain't about that, not entirely. I'm not saying she ain't the main problem, I'm sure she is. But there's something else going on here. Our mutual friend, he refers to Benton, is making that loud and clear. And you know her.
Now he means Scarpetta.
She's gonna end up right in the middle of shit.
Something else going on? Like what? Give me an example.
Lucy's tone changes. When she turns very serious, her voice gets slow and rigid, reminding Marino of drying glue. If there is trouble here in Richmond, Marino thinks, he's stuck all right. Lucy will be all over him like glue all right.
Let me tell you something, boss, he goes on. One of the reasons I'm still walking around is 'cause I got instincts.
Marino calls her boss, as if he is comfortable with her being his boss, when of course he is anything but, especially if his remarkable instincts warn him that he is about to earn her disapproval.
And my instincts is screaming bloody murder right about now, boss, he is saying.
And a part of him knows damn well that Lucy and her aunt, Kay Scarpetta, see his insecurity when he starts trotting out bravado or bragging about his instincts or calling powerful women boss or Sherlock or other less polite appellations. But he just can't help himself, so he makes matters worse.
And I'll add this to the mix, he continues. I hate this stinking city. Goddamn, I hate this stinking place. You know what's wrong with this stinking place? They ain't got no respect, that's what.
I'm not going to say I told you so.
Lucy tells him so.
Her voice is setting like glue very quickly now.
Do you want us to come?
No, he says.
And it gripes him that he can't tell Lucy what he thinks without her assuming she should do something about it.
Right now I'm just giving you a heads up, boss, he says,
wishing he hadn't called Lucy and told her anything. It was a mistake to call her, he thinks. But if she finds out her aunt is having a hard time and he didn't say a word, Lucy will be all over him. When he first met her, she was 10 years old. 10. A pudgy little runt with glasses and an obnoxious attitude. They hated each other. Then things changed and she hero-worshipped him. And then they became friends, and then things changed again. Somewhere along the line, he should have put a stop to progress, to all the changing. Because about 10 years ago, things were just right. And he felt good teaching her to drive his truck and ride a motorcycle, how to shoot, how to drink beer, how to tell if someone's lying. the important things in life. Back then, he wasn't afraid of her. Maybe fear isn't the right word to describe what he feels, but she has power in life, and he doesn't. And half the time, when he gets off the phone after talking to her, he feels down in the dumps and bad about himself. Lucy can do whatever she likes and still have money and order people around, and he can't. Not even when he was a sworn police officer could he flaunt power the way she does. But he's not afraid of her, he tells himself. Hell no, he's not.
"We'll come if you need us," Lucy says over the phone. "But it's not a good time. I'm into something down here, and it's not a good time."
"I told you I don't need you to come," Marino says grumpily. And being grumpy has always been the magic charm that forces people to worry more about him and his moods than about themselves and their moods. "I'm telling you what's going on, and that's it. I don't need you. There's nothing for you to do."
"Good," Lucy says.
Grumpy doesn't work with her anymore. Marino keeps forgetting that.
"I've got to go."
Chapter 9. Lucy touches the paddle shift with her left index finger, and the engine kicks up 1,000 RPM with a roar as she slows down. Her sonar radar chirps, and the front alert flashes red, indicating police radar somewhere up ahead.
"I'm not speeding," she says to Rudy Musel,
who sits in the passenger seat near the fire extinguisher, and he is looking at the speedometer.
"Only going 6 miles over."
"I didn't say anything," he replies, glancing in his side-view mirror.
"Let me see if I'm right."
She keeps the car in third, and just a little over 40 miles per hour.
"The cop car's going to be at the next intersection looking for us yahoos who can't wait to hit the coast and haul ass."
"What's going on with Marino? Let me guess," Rudy says. "I need to pack a suitcase." Both of them keep up their constant scans, checking mirrors, noting other cars, aware of every palm tree, pedestrian, and building on this flat stretch of strip malls. Traffic is moderate and relatively polite at the moment on Atlantic Boulevard and Pompano Beach, just north of Fort Lauderdale.
"Yep," Lucy says. "Tally-ho!"
Her sunglasses are fixed straight ahead as she passes a dark blue Ford LTD that has just turned right off Powerline Road, an intersection with an Eckerd's drugstore and the discount meat market. The unmarked Ford slides in behind her in the left lane.
"You got him curious," Rudy says.
"Well, he's not paid to be curious," she says aggressively, as the unmarked Ford follows her. And she knows damn well the cop is hoping she'll do something that gives him cause to turn on his lights and check out the car and the young couple in it. "Look at that. People passing me in the right lane, and that guy over there's got an expired inspection sticker," she points. "And the cop's more interested in me."
She stops checking on him in the rearview mirror and wishes that Rudy would lighten his mood. Ever since she opened an office in Los Angeles, he has been out of sorts. She's not sure how, but clearly she's miscalculated his ambitions and needs in life. She assumed that Rudy would love a high-rise on Wilshire Boulevard, with a view so immense that on a clear day one can see Catalina Island. She was wrong, terribly wrong as she has ever been about anything she has ever assumed about him. A front is rolling in from the south, the sky divided into layers that vary between thick smoke to sunlit pearly gray. Cooler air pushes away rain that at times today was pounding, leaving puddles that blast the undercarriage of Lucy's low-slung car. Just ahead, a flock of migrating seagulls swirl over the road, flying low and in crazy directions, and Lucy drives on, the unmarked car dogging her rear.
"Marino doesn't have much to say," she answers Rudy's question from a moment ago. "Just that something's up in Richmond. As usual, my aunt is stepping into a mess."
"I heard you volunteer our services. I thought she was just going to consult about something. What's up?"
"I don't know if we need to do anything. We'll see. What's up is the chief, I can't remember his name, asked her help in a case. Some kid, a girl, who suddenly died, and he can't figure out why. His office can't, so no big surprise. He's not even been there 4 months, and he washes his hands of the first big problem and calls my aunt. Hey, how about you coming on up and stepping in this shit so I don't have to, right? I told her not to touch it, and now it seems there are other problems. Huge surprise. I don't know. I told her not to go back to Richmond, but she doesn't listen to me."
"Listens to you about like you listen to her," Rudy says.
"You know something, Rudy? I don't like this guy."
Lucy looks in her rearview mirror at the unmarked Ford. It is still on her bumper, and its driver is a dark-skinned person, perhaps a man, but Lucy can't tell, and she doesn't want to seem interested in him or even aware of him. And then something else occurs to her.
"Damn, I'm stupid," she says, incredulous. "My radar's not going off. What am I thinking? It hasn't made a chirp since that car pulled in behind us. It's not a police car with radar. It can't be. And he's following us."
"Easy," Rudy says. "Just drive and ignore him. Let's see what he does. Probably just some dude looking at your car. That's what you get for driving cars like this. I've told you and told you. Shit."
Rudy didn't used to lecture her. When they first met years ago at the FBI Academy, they became colleagues, then partners, then friends. And then he thought enough of her personally and professionally to leave law enforcement not long after she did and come work for her company, which might be described as an international private investigation firm, for lack of a better definition of what the Last Precinct or its employees do. Even some of the people who work for TLP don't know what it does and have never met its founder and owner, Lucy. Some employees have never met Rudy, or if they have, they don't know who he is or what he does.
"Run the plate," Lucy says.
Rudy has his palm-sized computer out, and he is logging on, but he can't run the plate number because he can't see it. The car has no license plate in front, and Lucy feels stupid for ordering him to run a number he can't see.
"Let him get in front of you," Rudy says. "I can't see his plate unless he gets in front."
She touches the left paddle and drops to second gear. Now she is going 5 miles below the speed limit, and the driver stays behind her. He doesn't seem interested in passing her.
"Okay, let the games begin," she says. "You're fucking with the wrong chicken, asshole."
She suddenly turns a hard right into a strip mall parking lot.
"Oh, shit, what the hell? Now he knows you're messing with him," Rudy says in annoyance.
"Get the plate now. You should be able to see it."
Rudy twists around in the seat, but he's not going to get the plate because the Ford LTD has turned off too and is still on their tail, following them through the parking lot.
"Stop," Rudy says to Lucy.
He is disgusted with her, completely disgusted with her.
"Stop the car right now."
She eases on the brake and shifts the car into neutral, and the Ford stops right behind her. Rudy gets out and walks toward it as the driver's window rolls down. Lucy has her window open, her pistol in her lap, and she watches the activity in her side-view mirror and tries to chase away her feelings. She feels stupid and embarrassed and angry and slightly afraid.
"You got a problem," she hears Rudy say to the driver, definitely a Hispanic male, a young one. "Me have a problem? I was just looking." "Maybe we don't want you looking. It's a free country. I can fucking look. You have the problem. Fuck you. Go look somewhere else. Now get the hell out of here," Rudy says without raising his voice. "You follow us one more time, you're going to jail, you fucking piece of shit."
Lucy has the bizarre urge to laugh out loud as Rudy flashes his fake credentials. She is sweating, and her heart is beating wildly, and she wants to laugh and get out of the car and kill the young Hispanic male. And she wants to cry, and because she understands nothing about her feelings, she sits behind the wheel of her Ferrari and doesn't move. The driver says something else that she can't make out, and angrily drives off, squealing rubber. Rudy walks back to the Ferrari and climbs in.
"Way to go," he says as she slips back into the traffic on Atlantic. "Just some punk interested in your car, and you have to turn it into an international incident. First you think some cop's following you because the car is a black Crown Vic. Then you notice that your radar detector isn't detecting a damn thing. So next you think, what? What did you think? The mafia? Some hitman who's going to take us out in the middle of a busy highway?"
She doesn't blame Rudy for losing his temper with her, but she can't allow it.
"Don't yell at me," she says.
"You know what? You're out of control. You're unsafe."
"This is about something else," she says, trying to sound sure of herself.
"You're damn right it is," he retorts. "It's about her. You let someone stay in your house, and look what happens. You could be dead. She sure as hell should be dead. And something worse is going to happen if you don't get a grip."
"She was being stalked, Rudy. Don't make it my fault. It's not my fault."
"Stalked? You're damn right. She sure as hell was being stalked, and it sure as hell is your fault. If you would drive something like a Jeep, or drive the Hummer. We have company Hummers. Why don't you drive one of those once in a while? If you hadn't let her drive your damn Ferrari, showing off Miss Hollywood, Jesus, in your damn Ferrari.
Don't get jealous.
I'm not jealous, he yells.
You've been acting jealous since we hired her.
This isn't about your hiring her. Hired her to do what? She's going to protect our L.A. clients?
What a joke. So you hired her to do what? To do what? You can't talk to me like this, Lucy says quietly.
And she is surprisingly calm, but she has no choice. If she fires back at him, then they'll really have a fight and he might do something terrible, like quit.
I won't be run out of my own life. I'll drive what I want and live where I want.
She stares fiercely straight ahead, at the road, at the cars turning off on side streets and into parking places.
I'll be generous to whoever I want. She wasn't allowed to drive my black Ferrari, you know that. But she took it out, and that's what started everything. He saw her, followed her, and then look what happens. It's nobody's fault, not even hers. She didn't invite him to vandalize my car and follow her and try to kill her.
Good. You live your life the way you want, Rudy replies. And we'll just keep pulling into parking lots, and maybe next time I'll beat up some innocent stranger who was just looking at your damn Ferrari. Hell, maybe I'll get to shoot someone, or maybe I'll get shot. That would be even better, right? Me get shot over a stupid car.
Calm down, Lucy says as she stops at a red light. Please calm down.
I could have handled that better, I agree.
Handled? I didn't notice you handling anything. You just reacted like an idiot.
Rudy, stop it, please. She doesn't want to get so angry with him that she makes a mistake.
You can't talk to me like this. You can't. Don't make me pull rank.
She turns left on A1A, driving slowly along the beach, and several teenaged boys almost fall off their bicycles as they turn around to stare at her car. Rudy shakes his head and shrugs as if to say, I rest my case. But talk about the Ferrari is no longer about the Ferrari. For Lucy to change the way she lives is to allow him to win, and she thinks of the beast as a him. Henry called him a beast, and he is a male beast. Lucy believes that. She has no doubt of that. The hell with science, the hell with evidence, the hell with everything. She knows damn well the beast is a him. He is either a cocky beast or a stupid beast, because he left two partial fingerprints on the glass-covered bedside table. He was stupid or careless to leave prints, or maybe he doesn't care. So far, the partial prints aren't matching up with any prints in any automated fingerprint identification system. So maybe he doesn't have a 10-print card in any database because he's never been arrested, or his prints have never been taken for some other reason. Maybe he didn't care when he left three hairs on the bed, three black head hairs. And why should he care? Even when a case is high priority, mitochondrial DNA analysis can take 30 to 90 days. There is no certainty that the results will be worth a damn, because there is no such thing as a centralized and statistically significant mitochondrial DNA database, and unlike the nuclear DNA of blood and tissue, the mitochondrial DNA of hair and bones isn't going to tattle on the perpetrator's gender. The evidence the beast left doesn't matter. It may never matter unless he becomes a suspect and direct comparisons can be made.
All right, I'm rattled. I'm not myself. I'm letting it get to me, Lucy says, concentrating hard on her driving. Worried that maybe she is losing control, that maybe Rudy is right. What I did back there shouldn't have happened. Never. I'm too careful for that kind of shit.
You are. She's not.
Rudy's jaw is set stubbornly, his eyes blacked out by non-polarized sunglasses that have a mirrored finish. Right now he refuses to give Lucy his eyes, and that bothers her.
I thought we were talking about the Hispanic guy back there, Lucy replies.
You know what I told you from day one, Rudy says. The danger of someone living in your house, someone using your car, your stuff, someone flying solo in your airspace, someone who doesn't know the same rules you and I do and sure as hell doesn't have our training or care about the same things we do, including us.
Not everything in life should be about training, Lucy says.
And it is easier to talk about training than whether someone you love really cares. It is easier talking about the Hispanic than Henry.
I should never have handled it like that back there, and I'm sorry.
Maybe you've forgotten what life is really like, Rudy replies.
Oh, please don't go into your Boy Scout Be Prepared shit, she snaps at him,
and speeds up, going north, getting close to the Hillsborough neighborhood,
where her salmon-colored stucco Mediterranean mansion overlooks an inlet that connects the intercoastal waterway to the ocean.
I don't think you can be objective. You can't even say her name, someone this and someone that.
Ha! Objective? Ha! You should talk!
His tone is dangerously approaching cruel.
That stupid bitch has ruined absolutely everything, and you didn't have a right to do that. You didn't have a right to drag me along for the ride. You didn't have a right.
Rudy, we've got to stop fighting like this, Lucy says. Why do we fight like this?
She looks at him.
Everything isn't ruined.
He doesn't answer her.
Why do we fight like this? It's making me sick, she says.
They didn't used to fight. Now and then he sulked, but he never turned on her until she opened the office in Los Angeles and recruited Henry from the LAPD. A deep horn blares out a warning that the drawbridge is about to go up, and Lucy downshifts and stops again, this time getting a thumbs up from a man in a Corvette. She smiles sadly and shakes her head.
Yeah, I can be stupid, she says. Genetic wiring, bad wiring, from my crazy Latino biological father. Hopefully not from my mother, although it would be worse to be like her. Much worse.
Rudy says nothing, staring at the rising bridge giving way to a yacht.
Let's don't fight, she says. Everything isn't ruined. Come on.
She reaches over and squeezes his hand.
A truce? Start all over? Do we need to call in Benton for hostage negotiation? Because you're not just my friend and partner these days. You're my hostage, and I guess I'm yours, right? Here because you need the job, or at least want the job, and I need you. That's just the way it is.
I don't have to be anywhere, he says,
and his hand doesn't move. His hand is dead under hers, and she lets go of it and moves away.
How well I know,
she replies, hurt that he wouldn't touch her, and she places her rejected hand back on the steering wheel.
I live with that fear all the time these days. You're going to say, I quit. Goodbye, good riddance. Have a good life.
He stares at the yacht sailing through the open bridge, heading out to sea. The people on the deck of the yacht are dressed in Bermuda shorts and loose shirts, and move with the ease of the rare, very rich. Lucy is very rich, but she has never believed it. When she looks at the yacht, she still feels poor. When she looks at Rudy, she feels poorer.
Coffee? She asks. Will you have a coffee with me? We can sit out by that pool I never use and look out at the water I never notice in that house I wish I didn't have. I can be stupid, she says. Have a coffee with me.
Yeah, I guess.
He stares out the window like a sulking little boy as Lucy's mailbox comes into view.
I thought we were taking that thing down, he says, indicating the mailbox. You don't get mail at your house. The only thing you might get in that thing is something you don't want, especially these days.
I'll get the landscaper to take it down next time he comes, she says. I haven't been here much. Opening the office down here and everything else, I feel like the other Lucy. The Lucy of I Love Lucy? Remember that one when she's working in the candy factory and can't keep up because the candy's coming off the belt so fast?
No.
You probably never watched I Love Lucy even once in your entire life, Lucy says. My aunt and I used to sit around watching Jackie Gleason, Bonanza, I Love Lucy, the show she watched when she was growing up down here in Miami.
She slows almost to a stop at the offending mailbox at the end of her driveway. Scarpetta lives simply compared with how Lucy lives, and she warned Lucy about the house. For one thing, it's too opulent for the neighborhood, Scarpetta told her. It was a foolish decision to buy the house, and Lucy has turned on the house and calls the three-story, 11,000-square-foot mansion her $9 million townhouse because it is built on a third of an acre. There isn't enough grass to feed a rabbit, just stonework and a small, disappearing-edged pool, a fountain, and a few palms and plants. Didn't her Aunt Kay nag her about moving here? No privacy or security, and accessible to boaters, Scarpetta said when Lucy was too busy and preoccupied to give a part-time domain the appropriate attention, when she was obsessed with making Henry happy.
You'll be sorry, Scarpetta said.
Lucy moved here not even 3 months ago, and she's as sorry as she's ever been in her life. Lucy presses one remote control to open her gate, and another one to open her garage.
Why bother? Rudy is talking about her gate. The damn driveway's 10 feet long.
Tell me about it, Lucy says angrily. I hate this goddamn place.
Before you know it, someone's on your ass and inside your garage, Rudy says.
Then I have to kill them.
This isn't a joke.
I'm not joking, Lucy says, as the garage door slowly shuts behind them. Chapter 10. Lucy parks the Modena next to the black Ferrari, a 12-cylinder Scaglietti that will never realize its power in a world that regulates speed. She won't look at the black Ferrari as she and Rudy climb out of the Modena. She looks away from the damaged hood, from the crude sketch of the huge eye with eyelashes that is etched into the beautiful, glossy paint.
Not that it's a pleasant subject, Rudy says, walking between the two Ferraris toward the door that leads inside the mansion. But is it possible she did it?
He indicates the scratched hood of the black Scaglietti, but Lucy won't look.
I'm still not sure she didn't, that she didn't stage the whole thing.
She didn't do it, Lucy says, refusing to look at the damaged hood. I had to wait on a list for more than a year to get that car.
It can be fixed, Rudy says,
and he digs his hands into his pockets as Lucy lets them in and deactivates an alarm system that has every detection device imaginable, including cameras inside the house and out. But the cameras don't record. Lucy decided she didn't want to record her private activities inside her house and on her property, and Rudy can understand up to a point. He wouldn't want hidden cameras recording him all over his house either. But these days there wouldn't be much to record in his life. He lives alone. When Lucy decided she didn't want her cameras to record what went on in and around her house, she wasn't living alone.
Maybe we should change your cameras over to ones that record, Rudy says.
I'm getting rid of this place, Lucy replies. He follows her into the huge granite kitchen and looks around the magnificent dining and living area and out at the panoramic view of the inlet and the ocean. The ceiling is 20 feet high, and has been hand-painted with a Michelangelo-like fresco that is centered by a crystal chandelier. The glass dining room table looks carved out of ice and is the most incredible thing he has ever seen. He doesn't try to figure out what she paid for the table and the buttery soft leather furniture and the African wildlife art, the huge canvases of elephants, zebras, giraffes, and cheetahs. Rudy couldn't begin to afford a single light fixture in Lucy's part-time Florida house. Not a single silk rug, probably not even some of the plants. I know, she says as he looks around. I fly helicopters and can't even work the movie theater in this place. I hate this place.
Don't ask for sympathy.
Hey, she arrests the conversation with a tone he recognizes. She has had enough bickering. He opens one of the freezers in search of coffee and says,
What you got to eat in this place?
Chili, homemade. Frozen, but we can zap it.
Sounds like a plan. Want to go to the gym later, like maybe 5:30 or so?
Got to, she replies. It is just now that they notice the back door leading out to the pool, the same door he, whoever he is, used to enter and leave her house not even a week ago. The door is locked, but something is stuck to the outside glass, and Lucy is already walking quickly that way before he realizes what has happened, and she jerks open the door and stares at a sheet of unlined white paper hanging by a single strip of tape.
What is it? Rudy asks, shutting the freezer and looking at her. What the hell is it?
Another eye, Lucy says. A drawing of another eye. The same eye, in pencil. And you thought Henry did it. She's not even within 1,000 miles of here, and you thought she did it. Well, now you know. Lucy unlocks the door and opens it. He wants me to know he's watching, she says angrily, and she steps outside to get a better look at the drawing of the eye.
Don't touch, Rudy yells at her.
What do you think, I'm stupid? She yells back at him. Chapter 11.
Excuse me, says a young man who is suited up in purple scrubs, face shield and mask, and hair and shoe covers, and double pairs of latex gloves.
He looks like a parody of an astronaut as he moves closer to Scarpetta.
What do you want us to do with her dentures? He asks.
Scarpetta starts to explain that she doesn't work here, but words vanish before they leave her brain, and she finds herself staring at the obese dead woman as two people, also suited up as if expecting a plague, tuck her inside a body pouch on a gurney sturdy enough to bear her enormous weight.
She has dentures, the young man in purple scrubs says, this time to Fielding. We put them in a carton and then forgot to put them inside the bag before we sewed her up.
You don't want them inside the bag. Scarpetta decides to handle this amazing problem herself. They need to go back inside her mouth. The funeral home, the family, will want them inside her mouth. She would probably appreciate being buried with her teeth.
So, we don't need to open her up and get the bag, says the man in purple. Phew, that's good.
Forget the bag, Scarpetta tells him. You never want to put dentures in the bag, she says of the sturdy, transparent plastic bag that is sewed up inside the obese dead woman's empty chest cavity. The bag that contains her sectioned organs, which were not returned to their original anatomical positions, because it isn't the forensic pathologist's job to put people back together again. Nor is it possible. But it would be rather much like returning a stew to the condition of a cow. Where are her dentures? Scarpetta asks.
Right over there.
The young man in purple scrubs points to a countertop on the other side of the autopsy suite,
with her paperwork.
Fielding wants nothing to do with this lobotomized problem and completely ignores the man in purple, who looks too young to be a rotating medical student and likely is another soldier from Fort Lee. He might have a high school education and is spending time at the OCME because his military duty requires that he learn to handle the war dead. Scarpetta is inclined to say, but doesn't, that even soldiers blown up by grenades would like their dentures to go home with them, preferably inside their mouths, if they still have mouths. Come on, she says to the Fort Lee soldier in purple. Let's go take a look. She accompanies him across the tile floor, passing another gurney that was rolled out moments earlier, this one bearing a gunshot victim, a young black man with strong arms that are covered with tattoos and folded stiffly across his chest. He has goosebumps, a post-mortem reaction of his erector pili muscles to rigor mortis that makes him look cold or frightened or both. The Fort Lee soldier picks up the plastic carton from the countertop and starts to hand it to Scarpetta, then notices that she isn't wearing gloves. I guess I'd better get dressed again, she says, passing on green nitrile gloves, opting instead for a pair of old-fashioned latex ones that she whips out of a box on a nearby surgical cart. She works her hands into the gloves and takes the dentures out of the container. She and the soldier walk back across the tile floor toward the toothless, dead woman. You know, next time you have a problem, Scarpetta says to the young soldier in purple, you can just place the dentures with the personal effects and let the funeral home deal with them. Don't ever put them in the bag. This lady's awfully young for dentures.
I think she was on drugs.
Based on what?
Someone said so, the soldier in purple replies.
I see. Scarpetta considers, leaning over the enormous sutured-up body on the gurney. Vasoconstrictor drugs, like cocaine, and out fall the teeth.
I always wondered why drugs do that, says the soldier in purple. You new here?
He looks at her. No, just the opposite, Scarpetta replies, working her fingers into the dead woman's mouth. Very old around here. Just visiting. He nods, confused.
Well, you look like you know what you're doing, he says awkwardly. I sure am sorry about not putting her dentures back in. I feel real stupid. I hope nobody tells the chief.
He shakes his head and blows out a loud breath.
That's all I need. He don't like me anyway.
Rigor mortis has come and gone, and the obese dead woman's jaw muscles do not resist Scarpetta's prying fingers. But the gums don't want the dentures for the simple reason that they don't fit. These aren't hers, Scarpetta says, placing the dentures back into the carton and returning it to the soldier in purple. They're too big, much too big. Maybe a man's? Was there someone else just in here with dentures, and maybe there's been a mix-up? The soldier is baffled, yet happy with the news. This isn't his fault.
I don't know, he says. Sure have been a lot of people in and out of here. So these aren't hers? Just a good thing I didn't try to cram them in her mouth.
Fielding has noticed what is going on, and suddenly is there, staring down at the bright pink synthetic gums and white porcelain teeth inside the plastic carton that the soldier in purple is holding.
What the hell? Fielding blurts out. Who mixed this up? You put the wrong case number on this carton?
He glares at the soldier in purple, who can't be more than 20 years old, his short, light blonde hair peeking out from under the blue surgical cap, his wide brown eyes unnerved behind scratched safety glasses.
I didn't label it, sir,
he addresses Fielding, his superior officer.
I just know it was here when we started working on her, and she didn't have no teeth in her mouth, not when we started on her.
Here? Where is here?
On a cart?
The soldier indicates the cart bearing the surgical instruments for Table 4, also known as the Green Table. Dr. Marcus's morgue still uses the Scarpetta system of keeping track of instruments with strips of colored tape, ensuring that a pair of forceps or rib cutters, for example, don't end up elsewhere in the morgue.
This carton was on her cart, then somehow it got moved over there with her paperwork.
He looks across the room to the countertop where the dead woman's paperwork is still neatly spread out.
There was a view on this table earlier, Fielding says.
That's right, sir. An old man who died in bed. So maybe the teeth are his, says the soldier in purple.
So it was his teeth on the cart?
Fielding looks like an angry blue jay flapping across the autopsy suite and yanking open the enormous stainless steel door of the cooler. He vanishes inside a rush of cold, dead-smelling air and reemerges almost instantly with a pair of dentures that he apparently removed from the old man's mouth. Fielding holds them in the palm of a gloved hand stained with the blood of the tractor driver who ran over himself.
Anybody can see these are too damn small for that guy's mouth, Fielding complains. Who stuck these in that guy's mouth without checking that they fit?
He asks the noisy, crowded, epoxy-sealed room, with its four bloody, wet steel tables, and x-rays of projectiles and bones on bright light boxes, and steel sinks and cabinets, and long countertops covered with paperwork, personal effects, and streamers of computer-generated labels for cartons and test tubes. The other doctors, the students, soldiers, and today's dead, have nothing at all to say to Dr. Jack Fielding, second-in-command to the chief. Scarpetta is shocked in a sick, disbelieving way. Her former flagship office is out of control, and so is everybody in it. She glances at the dead tractor driver, half-undressed on his red, clay-stained sheet, on top of a gurney, and she stares at the dentures in Fielding's blood-stained, gloved hands. Scrub those things before you put them in her mouth, she can't help but say as Fielding hands the misplaced dentures to the soldier in purple. You don't need another person's DNA or other people's DNA in her mouth, she tells the soldier. Even if this isn't a suspicious death. So scrub her dentures, his dentures, everybody's dentures. She snaps off her gloves and drops them in a bright orange biohazard trash bag. As she walks off, she wonders what has become of Marino. And she overhears the soldier in purple saying something, asking something, apparently wanting to know exactly who Scarpetta is and why she is visiting and what just happened.
She used to be the chief here, Fielding says, failing to explain that the OCME wasn't run anything like this back then. Holy shit, the soldier exclaims.
Scarpetta hits a large wall button with her elbow, and stainless steel doors swing open wide. She walks into the dressing room, past cabinets of scrubs and gowns, then through the women's locker with its toilets and sinks and fluorescent lights that make mirrors unkind. She pauses to wash her hands, noticing the neatly written sign, one she posted herself when she was here, that reminds people not to leave the morgue with the same shoes on that they wore in it. Don't track biological menaces onto the corridor carpet, she used to remind her staff. And she feels sure nobody cares about that or anything else anymore. She takes off her shoes and washes the bottom of them with antibacterial soap and hot water, and dries them off with paper towels before walking through another swinging door to the not-so-sterile, grayish-blue carpeted corridor. Directly across from the women's locker room is the glass-enclosed chief medical examiner suite. At least Dr. Marcus exerted the energy to redecorate. His secretary's office is an attractive collection of cherry-stained furniture and colonial prints, and her computer screensaver shows several tropical fish swimming endlessly on a vivid blue screen. The secretary is out, and Scarpetta knocks on the chief's door.
Yes, his voice faintly sounds from the other side.
She opens the door and walks into her former corner office, and avoids looking around, but can't help taking in the tidiness of the bookcases and the top of Dr. Marcus's desk. His workspace looks sterile. It is only the rest of the medical examiner's wing that is in chaos.
Your timing is perfect, he says from his leather swivel chair behind the desk. Please sit and I'll brief you on Jilly Paulson before you take a look at her.
Dr. Marcus, this isn't my office anymore, Scarpetta says. I realize that. It's not my intention to intrude, but I'm concerned.
Don't be. He looks at her with small, hard eyes.
You weren't brought here as some sort of accreditation team.
He folds his hands on top of the ink blotter.
Your opinion is sought in one case and one case only, the Jilly Paulson case. So I strongly encourage you not to overtax yourself with how different you might find things here. You have been gone a long time. What, 5 years? And during most of that period of time, there was no chief, just an acting chief. Dr. Fielding, as a matter of fact, was the acting chief when I got here just a few months ago. So yes, of course, things are very different. You and I have very different management styles, which is one of the reasons the Commonwealth hired me.
It's been my experience that if a chief never spends time in the morgue, there will be problems, she says, whether he wants to hear it or not. If nothing else, the doctors sense a lack of interest in their work. And even doctors can get careless, lazy, or dangerously burned out and undone by the stress of what they see every day. His eyes are flat and hard like tarnished copper, his mouth fixed in a thin line. Behind his balding head, the windows are clean as air, and she notices that he has replaced the bulletproof glass. The Colosseum is a brown mushroom in the distance, and a dreary drizzle has begun to fall. I can't turn a blind eye to what I see. Not if you want my help, she says. I don't care if it is one case and one case only, as you put it. Certainly you must know all things are used against us in court and elsewhere. Right now, it's the elsewhere that worries me.
I'm afraid you're talking in riddles, Dr. Marcus replies, his thin face staring coldly at her. Elsewhere? What is elsewhere?
Usually scandal, usually a lawsuit. Or, worst of all, a criminal case that is destroyed by technicalities, by evidence that is ruled inadmissible because of impropriety, because of flawed procedures, so there is no court. There is no trial.
I was afraid this was going to happen, he says. I told the commissioner what a bad idea this was.
I don't blame you for telling him that. No one wants a former chief reappearing to straighten up.
I warned the commissioner that the last thing we needed was a disgruntled former employee of the Commonwealth dropping by to fix things, he says, picking up a pen and setting it down again, his hands nervous and angry. I don't blame you for feeling, especially crusaders, he says coldly. They're the worst. Nothing worse than a crusader, unless it is a wounded one. Now you're getting, but here we are, so let's make the best of it, shall we?
I would appreciate your not interrupting me, Scarpetta says. And if you're calling me a wounded crusader, then I'll choose to accept that as a compliment, and we'll move along to the subject of dentures. He stares at her as if she has gone mad. I just witnessed a mix-up in the morgue, she says. The wrong dentures with the wrong decedent. Carelessness. And too much autonomy for young Fort Lee soldiers who have no medical training and, in fact, are here to learn from you. Suppose some family gets their loved one returned to the funeral home, and there's an open casket, and the dentures are missing or don't fit. You have the beginning of a disintegration that is hard to stop. The press loves stories like that, Dr. Marcus. You mix up those dentures in a homicide case, and you've just given the defense attorneys quite a gift, even if the dentures have absolutely nothing to do with anything.
Whose dentures? He asks, scowling. Fielding is supposed to be supervising.
Dr. Fielding has too much to do, she replies.
So now we get to that. Your former assistant.
Dr. Marcus rises from his chair. He does not tower over the desk. Not that Scarpetta ever did, because she isn't tall either. But he seems small as he erupts from behind the desk and moves past the table with a microscope shrouded in plastic.
It's already 10 o'clock, he says, opening his office door. Let's get you started on Jilly Paulson. She's in the decomp fridge, and it's best you work on her in that room. No one will bother you there. I suppose you've decided to re-autopsy.
I'm not doing this without a witness, Scarpetta says. Chapter 12. Lucy doesn't sleep in the third-floor master suite anymore, but locks herself into a much smaller bedroom downstairs. She tells herself she has sound investigative reasons for not sleeping in that bed, the one Henry was attacked in. That huge bed with a hand-painted headboard in the center of a palatial suite that overlooks the water. Evidence, she thinks. No matter how fastidious she and Rudy are, it is always possible that evidence was missed. Rudy has driven off in her Modena to gas it up. Or at least this was his excuse when he plucked the keys off the kitchen counter. He has another agenda, Lucy suspects. He is cruising. He wants to see who follows him, assuming anybody does, and probably nobody in his right mind would follow someone as big and strong as Rudy. But the beast who drew the eye, two eyes now, is out there. He is watching. He watches the house. He might not realize Henry is gone, so he continues to watch the house and the Ferraris. He might be watching the house right now. Lucy walks across tawny carpet past the bed. It is still unmade, the soft, expensive covers pulled over the foot of the mattress and spilled onto the floor in a silk waterfall. Pillows are shoved to one side, exactly where they were when Lucy ran up the flights of stone steps and found Henry unconscious on the bed. At first, Lucy thought she was dead. Then she didn't know what to think. She still doesn't know what to think. But at the time, she was frightened enough to call 911, and what a mess that has caused. They had to deal with the local police, and the last thing Lucy ever wants is the police involved in her secret lives and activities, many of them illegal means to just ends, and of course, Rudy is still furious. He accuses Lucy of panicking, and she did. She should never have called 911, and he's right. They could have handled the situation themselves, and should have. Henry isn't Susie Q. Citizen, Rudy said. Henry is one of their agents. It didn't matter if she was out cold and naked. She was breathing, wasn't she? Her pulse and blood pressure weren't dangerously fast or low, were they? She wasn't bleeding, was she? Just a little bit of a bloody nose, right? It wasn't until Lucy flew Henry on a private jet to Aspen that Benton offered an explanation that unfortunately makes sense. Henry was attacked and may have been unconscious briefly, but after that, she was faking. No way, Lucy argued with Benton when he told her that. She was completely unresponsive.
She's an actor, he said.
Not anymore.
Come on, Lucy. She was a professional actor half her life before she decided to change careers. Maybe becoming a cop was simply another acting role for her. It may be that she can't do anything but act.
But why would she do something like that? I kept touching her, talking to her, trying to make her wake up. Why would she do it? Why?
Shame and rage. Who knows why exactly, he said. She may not remember what happened, may have repressed it, but she has feelings about it. Maybe she was ashamed because she didn't protect herself. Maybe she wants to punish you.
Punish me for what? I didn't do anything. What, she's practically been murdered and it occurs to her, oh, I'll punish Lucy while I'm at it.
You'd be surprised what people do.
No way, Lucy told Benton. And the more adamant she was, the more he probably knew he was right. She walks across the bedroom to a wall of eight windows that are so high it isn't necessary to cover the top half of them with shades. The shades are drawn over the lower half of the windows, and she presses a button on the wall, and the shades electronically retract with a soft whirr. She stares out at the sunny day, scanning her property to see if anything is different. She and Rudy were in Miami until very early this morning. She hasn't been back to her home in 3 days, and the beast had plenty of time to wander and spy. He came back looking for Henry. He walked right across the patio to the back door and taped his drawing on it to remind Henry, to taunt her, and no one called the police. People are vile in this neighborhood, Lucy thinks. They don't care if you're beaten to death or burglarized, as long as you don't do anything that might make life unpleasant for the rest of them. She gazes at the lighthouse on the other side of the inlet and wonders whether she should dare go next door. The woman who lives next door never leaves her house. Lucy doesn't know her name, only that she is nosy and takes photographs through the glass whenever the yard man trims the hedges or cuts the grass in back by the pool. Lucy supposes the neighbor wants proof should Lucy allow anything done to the yard that might alter the nosy neighbor's view or somehow cause her emotional distress. Of course, had Lucy been allowed to top off her 3-foot walls with another 2 feet of wrought iron, the beast might not have had such an easy time getting onto her patio and into her house, and up to the bedroom where Henry was sick with the flu. But the nosy neighbor fought the variance and won, and Henry was almost murdered. And now Lucy finds a drawing of an eye that is like the eye scratched on the hood of her car. 3 stories down, the pool disappears over its edge, and beyond is the deep blue water of the Intracoastal Waterway, then a spit of beach, and the dark blue-green ruffled water of the ocean. Maybe he came by boat, she thinks. He could tie up at her seawall and climb up the ladder, and there he would be, right on her patio. Somehow she doesn't think he arrived by boat, or even has a boat. She doesn't know why she thinks that. Lucy turns around and walks closer to the bed. To the left of it, in the top drawer of a table, is Henry's Colt 357 Magnum revolver, a lovely stainless steel gun that Lucy bought for her because it is a piece of art with the sweetest action on earth. Henry knows how to use a gun, and she isn't a coward. Lucy believes without a doubt that had Henry heard the beast inside the house, flew or not, she would have shot him dead. End of Disc 3.